From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Say women and problem drinking, and we tend to picture this.
I like Malibu Bay Breezes. I like Vodka Bay Breezes.
But there's another group of women taking to the bottle.
Because I was going so often, I had a little notebook that I kept track of which liquor store I went to, which employees were working at that time.
A look at women and drinking, and why booze marketing targeting females has public health researchers concerned.
This is a product that's responsible for example, 15% of breast cancer cases.
Also on the show, the comeback of the bald eagle. And is this patient real?
Stick out your tongue and say,
First, the news. Booze makers are tapping a new market.
Mix like a lady. Entertain like a lady.
And public health experts are not happy.
We've seen a shift in the culture of women's drinking, and there's a big marketing piece of that.
It's The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse will listen to frog mating calls and dissect buzzwords to really understand the latest research and treatments.
It wouldn't shock me if we hit 90 in April.
And we just kind of sat there for a couple of seconds in silence, taking this in. Like,
I thought, there has to be a better way to do this. You know, do this, all of this.
The only data that was with the specimen was Cretaceous of New Jersey.
I call it one of the final frontiers in body odor analysis.
It is absolutely like playing Tetris.
Recognizing that the virus needed this.
These rumors were
all required.
Hey, how are you? Sorry, I'm running behind schedule.
On today's show, a daughter deals with her mother's hoarding and uncovers pieces of her childhood. A budding bald eagle obsession, and a journey to the bottom of the ocean. But first up, women and alcohol. Public health officials are calling attention to women's drinking lately. Last year, the Centers for Disease Control released a report on women and binge drinking. Several books on the topic have also led to a lot of debate. Reporter Tanya English is here to walk us through the issues. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Mikan. So when I say the term risky drinking, what comes to mind?
I don't know. Girls gone wild, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. I think of that, too. A lot of us do associate problem drinking with young people in college. So we spoke with a public health professor to better understand alcohol consumption on campus. And then we headed out to a bar near Bryn Mawr to speak with some Wednesday night drinkers.
My name's Abby. I'm from Ardmore. I like Malibu Bay Breezes. I like Vodka Bay Breezes. I have a wonderful tolerance to fruity drinks.
The binge drinking definition had been five or more drinks on a single occasion. My name is Tobin Nelson, and I'm an associate professor of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota. Women were experiencing problems at the same level as men after they had consumed fewer drinks. So we went back and changed the definition for women to four or more drinks on a single occasion.
You know, I don't really count. My name is Faith Parkway. I'm from Tennessee. Binge drinking. I think it's when your motive for drinking is to become blackout drunk and do stupid things that you would not do sober.
Shama-lama-ding-dong.
In some ways, individual students are too deep in the bucket to be able to see kind of what's going on other than what's sort of in their immediate environment. In a culture where there's lots of people around them who are drinking, that just seems normal.
So I was drinking gin. I was drinking a lot of it. It was before I really understood how alcohol works, and I thought it was normal to just fill up cups with it. And I woke up and I was bald. It was a nice buzz cut, which, you know, was not a totally unpopular haircut. So people thought I was pretty cool. I didn't tell them all, you know, that it was an accident and that I didn't remember it.
Cheers!
We're talking about women and alcohol consumption with reporter Tanya English. Just heard from some Wednesday night drinkers there in the bar. Tanya, is the main health concern around young women?
No, not only young women, but that's where the story starts. The increase in women's drinking really began in the late 1990s with the launch of a new category of flavored, fruity, sometimes carbonated adult beverages. David Jernigan from Johns Hopkins is really worried about how this new category is being marketed to women.
So we've got Smirnoff Ice, we've got Mike's Hard Pink Lemonade, Pucker grape-flavored vodka.
It may be a surprise to find this stash in the office of a public health professor, but these bottles with their bright pink and purple labels, they're part of Jernigan's work. He tracks alcohol advertising.
We've seen a shift in the culture of women's drinking, and there's a big marketing piece of that.
Jernigan says any kind of education message is overwhelmed by the weight of marketing claims.
Entertain like a lady. Meet the new girl. Introducing the smooth, sassy, and low-cal Skinny Girl White Cherry Vodka.
It's a smart drink. It's the drink you want to drink when you're training for a marathon. It's a full-speed beer. And, of course, it's a diet beer. Their job is to sell the product. My job is to warn people about the danger of the product and to try to make sure that the people do not consume it in an unhealthy or harmful way.
The liquor industry has a code of conduct for its advertising. While Jernigan finds lots of ads aimed at women that he believes are degrading or lewd, there doesn't seem to be much of a consumer outcry. In all of 2013, there were just two complaints filed with the Distilled Spirits Council. Spokeswoman Lisa Hawkins says the industry is responsive to its consumers, and she says about half of those consumers are women.
So it's perfectly reasonable and appropriate for our companies to be able to develop and responsibly market products that appeal to women's taste and lifestyle choices.
To suggest otherwise is kind of sexist, according to Julie Gunlock. She's a commentator with the Independent Women's Forum, which opposes government regulation that gets in the way of free markets.
To say that women are victimized by this marketing, my goodness, they're so gullible. They put a high heel on a wine bottle and women just, you know, can't control themselves.
There's been a lot of talk lately about brands such as Mommy Juice and Skinny Girl, but Gunlock says there's been very little discussion about the millions of women who consume alcohol responsibly.
So we're trying to sort of hit back on the alarmism and remind women that we are not becoming like this population of boozed up moms. We just aren't. This just isn't happening, and yet the narrative out there is that it is.
Overall, excessive drinking is much more common among men. But last year, the Centers for Disease Control made the point that binge drinking among women is an under-recognized problem. Back at Johns Hopkins, David Jernigan doesn't mind pulling the alarm bell.
I have to look for the canary in the coal mine. We look at the UK, for example, where this started happening in the early 90s, not the late 90s. 20 years later, the United Kingdom has an epidemic of liver cirrhosis and liver cancer among women in their 20s. The cancer docs in the UK are blown away. They have never seen anything like this.
Women process alcohol differently than men, and that makes women more vulnerable to alcohol-related health risks.
It's also a huge problem because for young women, alcohol can cause problems for the fetus. This is a product that's responsible for example, 15% of breast cancer cases. We're not talking about the heart deaths. If you drink alcohol heavily over an extended period of time, you hurt your heart and you will die of alcohol-related heart disease.
Jernigan says if the level of advertising to women reaches the same level as for men, because of our biological differences, the harms for women will be greater.
Tanya, as I was listening to this information about ad campaigns specifically targeting women, I was thinking of, you know, the girls we met at the bar earlier. What do we know about older women and drinking?
For that part of the story, I spoke with Anne Dowsett Johnston. She's a journalist who wrote about her own experience in the book Drink, The Intimate Relationship Between Women and Alcohol. Johnston says that she's the poster child for the modern alcoholic. She's female, she's middle-aged, she's professional, well-educated, and high-bottom.
Okay.
That means Johnston had a big problem with white wine. For her, rock bottom actually looked pretty good on the surface. Given all that, I asked her what she did lose to drinking.
I lost my self-respect. I was losing my relationship with my 22-year-old son, who knew very much that I was drinking to pass out. Most people, women who are drinking too much, isolate and drink at home and drink at home alone. And I was hiding all of this from my best friend.
Why were you drinking?
I was definitely self-medicating depression. My depression was severe. My mom was cross-addicted for many, many years, decades, in fact, to Valium and alcohol. And I was so determined never to touch a pill, never to touch an antidepressant. And in choosing to do that, I avoided the kind of help that I should have been seeking a long, long time ago to deal with depression.
You've said that one of the rudest questions people ask is, how much did you drink? So I've got to ask, how much did you drink?
Near the end, I was definitely drinking a bottle of wine a night, and then I would often open a second bottle and have maybe one more glass. And near the very, very end, I was switching to vodka. I was switching to vodka hoping that I could get that buzz faster and be out of myself, out of my own skin more quickly.
You talk about the gap between women's drinking and men's drinking narrowing. Tell me more about that.
We are seeing the largest spike for women in heavy drinking between the ages of 24 and 36 years old. And if you're seeing a spiking of drinking in that age group, and primarily in the professional and better educated group of women, you have to say, why in that age group where typically women would graduate from college and they would slow down? They're not slowing down. They're not slowing down as young professionals. And I think it's worth asking the question why.
I worry that this discussion blurs the lines between any drinking and problem drinking.
I think that's a fair comment. I don't want to be a fearmonger. All I want to say is know your limits, know what safe drinking guidelines are, count your drinks, and you won't get into the same kind of trouble as I'm in. Nobody knows where that difficult line is that you cross when you become addicted to alcohol. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. We haven't had an adult discussion about alcohol.
How did you recover?
I went to rehab in the United States. It was enormously expensive. 30 days of treatment. I'm doing yoga. I'm doing meditation. I'm getting all sorts of education on alcohol and what to do about triggers and what to do about cravings. And I think I'm well armed for the real world. And I am drop kicked back into my old life. All the buttons are being pushed and they're being pushed hard. And before you know it, I've got maybe a month of sobriety and I'm drinking again. For 8 months, I could not paste together more than 2 or 3 weeks of sobriety and I would fall off the wagon. And it was humbling. It was difficult. I had to really learn how to live in the real world sober. I am a person in recovery. 23 million plus Americans live in recovery, pay their taxes, go to jobs, good to their families, have been able to cope with their addiction. The voices of these people are going to be increasingly important.
So are you the poster child now for someone in recovery?
Oh my goodness, I would never claim to be that. I take my recovery really seriously. I babysit it every day by taking care of myself, by going to meetings. It takes some concerted effort. I honestly believe that my addiction is out in the parking lot right now doing push-ups just waiting for me to slip.
Ann Dowsett Johnston's book is Drink, The Intimate Relationship Between Women and Alcohol. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tanya.
Tanya English produced our look at women and drinking with help from Laura Benchoff. To read an excerpt from Johnston's book Drink, go to whyy.org/thepulse. Last week on The Pulse, we discussed the impact of recreational marijuana use on the brain, and we got some feedback that our story didn't present all sides of this issue.
My name is Jehan Marku. I received my PhD for studying cannabis and cannabinoids. I am currently the research and development director of Green Standard Diagnostics, a laboratory and consulting company. I'm on the board of directors for the International Association for Cannabinoids as Medicine.
Marku especially disagreed with one study that was quoted in our report. It was done in New Zealand and found an 8-point drop in IQ in young people who used marijuana frequently.
The problem I have with that is it lists specifically 8 IQ points, which is actually almost impossible to measure that small of a change in IQ. And we weren't told anything else about it, but that it would mean the loss of a job was the following quote after that. But we're not told that measuring 8 IQ points between two people is almost unmeasurable and is meaningless too. And there are so many things that can affect your IQ and IQ scores. There has been no research that has ever shown that there are long-term consequences of cannabis on the brain. We just don't have any data. There has never been a good study published to show that these effects last more than 30 days, regardless of the amount of use.
But these researchers seem to quote studies that seem to have found just that.
Well, that's the problem when you don't actually read the study. So the New Zealand study they talked about had numerous problems. For instance, there was no dose dependency. There was no link between an amount of cannabis and an effect. They took into account alcohol dependence, but not binge drinking. A second paper came out which analyzed the data again and found that socioeconomic factors played a way bigger role than cannabis did in these people's lives. You know, when we're talking about these studies, you have to keep it in context of caffeine, of opiates, of nicotine, of alcohol, and talk about, you know, how those things interact together. Because when we're talking about drug studies, and the most difficult thing about doing these studies is it's never one drug. It's always multiple drugs. And how do you tease that out?
What do you think has to happen for there to be a real scientific debate over these issues?
Well, we have to discuss it more. We have to actually look beyond the headlines and see if people are actually backing up their facts. There's also a very limited source of funding to study cannabis. If you want to actually study a government-funded study, it generally has to be through the National Institute of Drug Abuse. So these studies have to be framed in a way that look for harm.
Jehan Marku is research director for Green Standard Diagnostics and is affiliated with an organization called Americans for Safe Access. Coming up on The Pulse, a journey to the bottom of the ocean.
Everything gets darker and darker around you as you descend, and after you get about a couple hundred feet down, it gets almost pitch black. You know that you're leaving the surface world when that happens. It's really a pretty magical thing.
Still to come on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. A team of Temple University researchers is embarking on a research cruise into the Gulf of Mexico to study the effects of ocean acidification on the deep sea. Marine biologist Eric Cordes is leading the effort. He explains that ocean acidification is a byproduct of rising CO2 levels in the atmosphere.
About half of the CO2 that we're dumping in the atmosphere ends up in the oceans. And what that does in the oceans is it's basically like making soda water. As you bubble CO2 through it, it becomes an acid and lowers the pH of the seawater. And this makes the seawater become corrosive to any organisms that lay down a skeleton or a shell made out of calcium carbonate. So that can be anything from oysters and clams and mussels, to the phytoplankton that form the base of the food chain, to corals and coral reefs. And that's what we're studying, are coral reefs in the deep sea, which not a lot of people know about to begin with, and then the effects of this human-generated process, this anthropogenic effect of ocean acidification, but in the deep sea.
Cordes and the other researchers take trips to the bottom of the ocean with the submersible Alvin, which is equipped to pick up samples. I asked him how far down they go.
On this mission, we'll be going anywhere from about 500 meters to about 1,500 meters, so as deep as about a mile. I've personally been about 2 miles down.
With Alvin?
With Alvin, yes.
So what's that like?
It's exciting. I mean, the best thing is you never know what you're going to see when you get in the sub. And every dive is unique, and every dive you get to see something that no one has ever seen before. And there are very few experiences you can have where you can say that. The first time I was in Alvin, I got kind of claustrophobic. It's only about 6 feet in diameter inside, and there are three of you in there, and they seal you in from the outside.
So you go down. Describe the way down. How long does it take?
So they seal you in on deck, and then you hit the water, and you're rocking around a little bit. You can feel the waves moving. You finish all your safety checks, and then they give you permission to dive. And then as soon as you get below the surface, all that motion goes away, and it's still and it's quiet, and you're slowly sinking down. Everything gets darker and darker around you as you descend. And after you get about a couple hundred feet down, it gets almost pitch black. You know that you're leaving the surface world when that happens. It's really a pretty magical thing. And then if the pilot's not working, you get them to turn out all the lights. And everything that you bump into on the way down glows. It causes this bioluminescent reaction, and this greenish light comes up. And so you can stare out the window and see all these little tiny organisms like stars slipping past the windows. It's really just a beautiful experience.
How long do you stay down there?
It's usually about 6 to 8 hours. So you get in the water right around 8, right after 8, and then you usually come up at the end of the afternoon around 4 or so.
And you dive every day during?
Not me personally. It's exhausting, actually. You wouldn't think that sitting on your butt for 8 hours would be exhausting, but it really is.
What's exhausting about it?
You actually keep the oxygen levels a little bit lower inside the sphere, mostly to prevent the possibility of fire. And so just like being at high altitudes, it's tiring to do anything.
And you're totally on top of each other, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a really small space, and you're working literally elbow to elbow.
Is there a bathroom?
I always get this question.
Sorry, I'm a woman.
there is a bottle, and you get two, and everyone has their own, and there is a female adapter, and everybody sort of turns around and looks out the window for a minute and pretends not to be listening.
So what have you found so far in terms of the science? Can you say anything about what is happening on the ocean floors?
We conducted a few previous studies over the past few years, and we were actually really surprised at our results. We found these deep water corals. It's called Lophelia is the name of the species. It forms large reefs, these beautiful coral reefs, just like you would see in shallow water. But they're down hundreds of meters where there's no light, and they're totally cut off from photosynthetic productivity. They're reliant on everything raining down from the surface. But what we found in our previous studies was that these deep water coral reefs are surviving at lower pH values than any other reefs on Earth. And what we're going out to see if we can discover is how they're doing that. What is it that allows them to survive under these incredibly harsh conditions that shallow water corals would die under? And if we can figure out how they're doing that, how they're able to still calcify and lay down their skeleton and survive under this ocean acidification, we might be able to find some key to being able to save some of the shallow water coral reefs, to see if maybe some of the shallow water corals could adapt to ocean acidification and survive the way that Lophelia is surviving.
And Eric, we're going to check in with you when you are on the ship, so we look forward to that.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. I believe submarines underneath deep blue sea.
Temple University marine biologist Eric Cordes studies the impact of ocean acidification on the deep sea, and we have great pictures from a previous research cruise on our website, whyy.org/thepulse, and we're actually going to talk to Cordes and his team while they're in the Alvin during one of their trips, so stay tuned for that on an upcoming episode of The Pulse. We recently heard about the Earth Microbe Biome Map on our show. This is a huge project where microbiologists are logging samples of microbes like bacteria or fungi into a database to get a better sense of our world on a microscopic level. Reporter Kimberly Haas is back with another story on this project. This one involves the International Space Station and a bacterium collected right here at WHYY.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Last Friday, NASA launched a cargo spaceship to bring supplies and scientific experiments to the International Space Station. Along for the voyage were 48 samples of microbes, one-celled life forms like bacteria, fungi, and amoebas. Microbiologists know that when it comes to microbes, we are seriously outnumbered. They estimate there are 10 times more microbial cells on us and in us than the number of our own cells in our bodies. We're carrying passengers with us everywhere we go. So as humans gear up for commercial space travel and spending extended periods of time in space, scientists are wondering, how will the microbes that are coming along with us behave in that environment?
The scientific reason is to see how well various microbes grow in microgravity compared to on Earth.
Microbiologist David Coyle is one of the scientists for the effort, which is called Project Mercury.
It's sort of a tortured acronym. It's microbial ecology researchers combining citizen science and university researchers on the ISS.
Researchers are widening their focus in their study of the microscopic world. Most microbes are benign or even beneficial to humans, but not too much attention has been paid to them.
Previous work has focused on the pathogens, focused on the disease-causing microbes, and we're interested in how sort of the rest of the ecosystem, the normal microbes from the built environment, behave in microgravity.
Which is an important thing to understand for long-term manned spaceflight.
Darlene Cavalier is director of Project Mercury and founder of the citizen science website, SciStarter.
They selected 48 microbial samples to send to the space station. They keep half of those samples at UC Davis to measure their growth rates, and the other half will be on the International Space Station.
The growth rates of the microbes in space and on Earth will be compared. As we prepare for more humans spending more time in space, scientists want to know beforehand how the bacteria and other microbes on them might behave up there. The samples came from many sources, sporting events and famous icons like the Liberty Bell. So it got us wondering, what sort of microscopic life might be lurking around WHYY? We took some samples, and a microbe found in one of them was chosen for the spaceflight. We'll keep you posted on how it's doing. For The Pulse, I'm Kimberly Haas.
Coming up on The Pulse, a daughter deals with her mother's hoarding.
And I would just have to sigh really loud in the rooms I was cleaning. And I had to focus on where I was in that one spot, because if I looked around, it was so overwhelming and so daunting.
That's next here on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Hoarding has become a bit of a spectacle these days. Reality TV shows like Hoarders or Buried Alive have viewers sitting on the edge of their couch, wondering just what kind of junk or creatures might pop up next.
Oh my God. This is the bedroom? What's in this box?
I don't even want to.
There's like, okay, I'm not doing that box.
No. Oh my gosh.
But hoarding, the extreme inability to get rid of things, is an expression of mental illness. Psychiatrists now recognize it as a distinct disorder. And as people get older, the condition can get worse. Sometimes it's up to the next generation to clean up.
You couldn't get in this room. It was mountains. I'm Lisa Friedman, and we're in Havertown at my mother's house. My mother is Marilyn Friedman, and she goes by Marjo, which was her Screen Actors Guild name, and she lived here for 62 years, pretty long time to be collecting things.
The house looks shabby. Furniture, books, papers, clothes are everywhere, making it hard to walk. In one corner, hundreds of cassette tapes are stacked. Marilyn used to enjoy taping conversations with guests. Stuff is messy, perhaps even a bit repulsive, but it does tell a story. It reveals a person's dreams and whispers about their losses.
My mom was married until she was about 65, and my father decided to go on a vacation to Florida to visit his brother and never came back. So he left her with the house and no money.
Last year, Lisa Friedman's mom, Marilyn, had to move into a nursing home after she broke her hip. And Lisa began to dig through layers and layers of her mother's stuff and the belongings of other people she had started to collect.
I knew from the time I was a teenager that something wasn't right. I didn't know what it was at the time because it started just by her collecting piles of articles. And she just loved collecting clippings. And it could be faces of magazines and that type of thing. But I knew that other friends' houses weren't filled with those things. I remember very vividly, one day came home after school and I had a friend down the street and she was inviting some other friends from junior high. And I remember when one of the girls came down my house to knock on the door to find me, I hid. I didn't want her to come into my house, so I acted like I wasn't here. Yeah, there was a lot of shame around it. It really began to escalate after my father left her. So she's 89, so it's about the last 35 years. I would, you know, come in and try to help her clean. She wouldn't let me touch anything. She didn't want to get rid of anything. She might use it someday. I tried to display some of the wonderful vintage clothing that my mother looked like Marlo Thomas back in the 60s. I mean, she was hot. You know, jewelry and hats, and even, as you can see, this is a fox collar, which you wouldn't find very, very much anymore. She loved to take, you know, poses, you know, for headshots and that type of thing. She's a beautiful woman. And the way that she hoarded other people's things, you see this gal here? This is a friend of hers that was an Olympic ice skater, a Russian Olympic ice skater. And I have found, that's just a couple photos, she found news articles and other photographs of this woman and has kept these, you know, in the house. She just had to keep those mementos of other people so I guess she could keep seeing the people that had passed on. As a matter of fact, this gal's ashes are somewhere in the house we found. I know, it's pretty creepy, right? Yeah. You know, she tells me many times that I didn't realize how poor she was as a child. She said she lived in 15 places. So, you know, she didn't really have a stable environment. And I think a lot of that comes from that. Once I get done with the house and sell it, I'll feel very relieved, you know, to put this behind. You know, I'd come here by myself or my partner would come with me. And I would just have to sigh really loud in the rooms I was cleaning because I had to focus on where I was in that one spot, because if I looked around, it was so overwhelming and so daunting. And I knew that there would come a point when I would be grateful for having gotten through, you know, the layers on top, because, you know, I've been able to connect the dots better of, you know, my history and, you know, be able to find the mother that I remember as a child. She's the love of my life and the bane of my existence, if I was to put it any other way.
We drove to visit Marilyn Friedman at the nursing home where she stays now. She says she misses her home.
I always like my home because all my things, quotation, are in my home. The gowns and all that stuff.
Hoarding is especially difficult with older populations, says Dr. Linda Welsh. She directs the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd. Mountains of things pose a greater health risk for older people, and their habit might get worse with dementia. I asked her what treatment looks like for hoarding.
Treatment looks very much like it does for other anxiety disorders or even depression. Cognitive behavioral treatment is certainly indicated, meaning we have to understand what the thought process is of the person that hoards or what their behavior is in terms of impulsive buying. Often it runs in families, and there's pretty clearly a biological component that we are now seeing with anxiety and even anxiety distinct from hoarding. Hoarding brains look a little bit different than other brains in the research that they're doing now.
Are hoarders typically aware that they have an issue?
Mostly not. A lot of them are in denial and they have very good reasons for living the way they live. So it's a particularly difficult area because there's not a lot of motivation to get rid of things, and it's usually that it's a bother to others rather than themselves. The interesting thing is, if you start to investigate what the issue is, it's not that they're sloppy or that they're disorganized or thoughtless. It's they worry and they want to make sure that things are protected and they have what they need and that other people are taken care of in a strange way. I had a really interesting incident with a patient of mine who collected newspapers, and I mean for years, and I asked her what the meaning was, which is very important in trying to figure out why and how to treat this issue. She said she holds on to obituaries, even if they're people she doesn't know, because she doesn't want to think that people disappear and that there's nothing left of them.
What's your advice for families who perhaps have an elderly family member who's a hoarder?
Well, first of all, lose the judgment. You know, the worst thing to do in terms of approach to treatment is go in and say, you know, this is a mess, this is junk. Watch your language. You have to recognize and understand that your relative may be very attached and have a discussion about it. Does it interfere with the way you're living? Would you like it to be different? Is there a place or a way we can organize things so you're not at risk? And kind of take a practical approach rather than a judgmental approach so that the person doesn't become defensive, which makes them hold on even tighter to the things that they are valuing. So you want to begin to understand what's behind the hoarding. If this doesn't work, then you have to seek professional counselors to come in and talk to the individual. And it may make sense to talk to the physician that cares for your family member and say, is it possible that medication could help with the anxiety that's behind the hoarding?
Linda Welsh directs the Anxiety and Agoraphobia Treatment Center in Bala Cynwyd.
I'll keep my belongings with me at all times. I'll keep my belongings with me at all times until I can carry no more. I'll put all my papers.
We expect a lot from our doctors: intelligence, thoroughness, skill. But we also want empathy, something we call bedside manner. Some physicians have this naturally. Others, not really. So how do medical students learn this very important skill? Reporter Marielle Segarra dropped in on a class of third-year Drexel Med students honing their people skills.
Is that every time it's you cough, you bring stuff up?
Not every time, but often.
Okay. All right. Have you had this problem before?
No.
No.
Okay. I mean, I've had colds and stuff before, but...
Never this cough.
I'm standing in a pitch-black observation room looking through double-sided glass. On the other end, a doctor in a white lab coat talks to a woman in a blue medical gown. The patient has short black hair and glasses.
All right, so you mentioned you're also short of breath, too, right? Tell me about that.
It started like a week and a half ago, maybe.
Okay.
I just kind of feel like I can't catch my breath sometimes.
Okay. That's pretty frustrating and kind of scary, too.
Yeah,
I'm sorry about that. So when does this happen?
After a few more minutes, the doctor starts to examine her.
All right, well, I'm going to start with the head and neck exam. I'm just going to look in your eyes, nose, I'm sorry, ears, eyes, nose, and mouth. Think you could open your mouth, stick out your tongue, and say,
He diagnoses her with asthma and prescribes her an inhaler.
We can start right away and trying to see if this helps the situation.
Gotcha.
Okay. All right. Well, it's great to meet you.
You too. Thanks.
Take care.
As soon as the door closes, the patient jumps down from the table and sits at the doctor's desk. She starts clicking around on the computer and pulls a book out of a drawer. Microphones hang from the ceiling, and a voice overhead says,
"Please close all stations."
That announcement signals the end of a simulated exam. The doctor in the room isn't actually a doctor. Well, at least not yet. He's a third-year medical student at Drexel University, and he's examining someone who isn't sick. She's a standardized patient. That's medical lingo for an actor, someone who follows a script and pretends to have a certain disease, like diabetes or cancer. The student knows she's acting, and he's being graded on how he diagnoses her. From the observation room, I can see 10 student exams at the same time, through 10 panes of double-sided glass. Dr. Dennis Novak is the Associate Dean of Medical Education at Drexel.
What's the major complaint that you hear from patients about their doctors? My doctor doesn't listen. So we actually teach students listening skills. And standardized patients can give feedback on whether or not they feel heard. So, that's part of empathy.
Dr. Novak tells me that to graduate med school, students have to pass tests where they examine and diagnose standardized patients. During their board exams their third year, they have to do 12 simulations in a row. Novak says standardized patient exams are about more than medical knowledge. They also test future doctors for empathy and interpersonal skills. Like earlier, when the student told his patient he knew her symptoms must be frustrating and scary. That all sounds great, but it's not always easy to show empathy to someone you know is acting. Novak says students sometimes have trouble taking standardized patients seriously. When he hears that, he shows them some tough love.
When I talk to them, I say, first of all, you need to get over that. You know, because first of all, these standardized patients are real patients of somebody else, and they're really pros. For the 15 minutes that they work with you, they are that patient. And they judge your ability to relate to them by how they would feel if you were really their doctor.
I caught up with some of Dr. Novak's students after a seminar. They said they've learned a lot from working with standardized patients. For one thing, the simulated exams give them a chance to mess up without killing or traumatizing someone. Here's Jonathan Rinchina, a third-year student.
You know, we learn all these, the basic sciences and the academic part of it and the lectures and whatnot, and then being able to apply it to actual person with what we're going to be doing in their future is a big step.
That's especially true for the difficult stuff, the gray areas and ethical questions, or the moments when a patient gets emotional. Here's Rachel Hess, another third-year student.
One lady was a great actress, and she was just crying because you had to break the news that her baby was going to die in the ICU, and she just like broke out in tears, and you're sitting there and you're like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, I don't know what to do. But it was great to get that experience before going to a patient and having to do that for the first time. It was kind of a nice easing into it.
Some standardized patients get really into the whole thing.
My students sometimes talk about we should give Academy Awards for certain standardized patients. Felicia plays a role of a young mother whose child has multiple handicaps and is on a ventilator. And she cries real tears 10 times in a row. And our students are really moved by her.
Dr. Novak is talking about Felicia Myers. She's been a standardized patient for 13 years.
I've actually turned it into a bit of a career.
Myers works at a few medical schools in Philadelphia, including Drexel. When I met her, she was sitting in the observation room watching student exams.
We buy into the scenario. We believe in what we're doing, and we enjoy the educational part of it and teaching part of it. So from our perspective, if you're not taking it seriously, it's offensive.
Meyer says it isn't hard for her to suspend disbelief.
Because if I am in that real position somewhere down the line, unfortunately, I want somebody to break that news to me in an empathetic way. I don't want someone to just stare at me, say I'm another name on a docket, you have cancer, and walk out the door.
In some programs, standardized patients also use their own bodies to teach students how to do physical exams. The standardized patient might say, here, rotate my arm like this, or you need to check for my heartbeat in these four places.
If you work in one institution long enough, you can see people progress. And so we become proud parents, sort of surrogate parents, and say, you know, you were so good when we saw you.
Sometimes Felicia teaches a student how to do an exam and then runs into that person 2 years later in a testing scenario.
So you have that moment where you're like, you remember, even though you can't say, I taught you that, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's sort of a look you share in that moment, but then you have to go into character and say, you know, I'm somebody else right now, and you two don't acknowledge it, but you're doing your job, they're doing their job, and you know, it's all about good medicine.
Back in the observation room, the patient with the black hair and glasses is still sitting at the doctor's desk, reading her book.
30 seconds to start.
As the warning sounds, she throws her book in a drawer, scrambles up, and hops onto the table, ready to greet another student.
You may begin.
For The Pulse, I'm Marielle Segarra.
Come in.
Our next story is brought to you by spring. The birds are chirping, frogs are hopping, and if you're lucky enough, you might even catch sight of the majestic, once-endangered bald eagle, whose wings span a whopping 6 feet. As The Pulse's Alana Gordon reports, Pennsylvania's eagles have recently made a comeback, going from near extinction to internet stardom.
Bald eagles have been on the brink of extinction for decades. Pollution, pesticides nearly knocked the population out. Not anymore.
Here we are in front of the nesting bald eagles at John Hines National Wildlife Refuge.
Gary Stoles is the manager of this 1,200-acre plot of protected land near the Philadelphia airport. He leads me to the edge of a freshwater creek. He points to the tallest tree on an island towards the other side, and more specifically to a large collection of sticks and a fork in the branches. It's an empty eagle's nest. Stoles says a pair arrived there a few years ago.
Just absolutely beautiful birds. Our national symbol had completely vanished from Philadelphia and was gone for more than 200 years. And now for 5 years in a row, they've been breeding here.
There are now nearly 300 nesting pairs in Pennsylvania. The State Game Commission recently changed the bird status from threatened to protected. It attributes the success to massive restoration efforts, river cleanings, and DDT bans. Stoles isn't sure we'll see the eagles today. I stop several park visitors who tell me they haven't seen them, but it's worth trying to catch a glimpse.
It's great. It's a wonderful bird. It's great to see them in the wild.
A couple times I've been here and flow right over our head, and it's just like, wow.
To me, they look like a Chinook. That's a helicopter. The way they lift off and just glides around and bring themselves back in so soft and all.
That's Mike Hirata, Ian Wilson, and Mac Boyd. They move on. Stoles and I wait. 5 minutes pass.
There's a turkey vulture flying right over top now, the other big bird.
10 minutes pass.
Here comes some wood ducks flying right overhead.
20 minutes.
This bald eagle right there.
To the left, Baldego.
Stoles jumps, a flash of brown and white zooms by the creek.
How cool is that? It just came right over the water looking for fish.
So it just like, it just swept down and in a, like a blink, it's gone.
Exactly. They just swoop right through looking for any fish on the surface to grab a quick meal and then go sit in a tree to roost. So that was the hunting mode.
Stoles and other park goers aren't the only ones captivated by Pennsylvania's eagles. Bill Powers heads a small video company near Pittsburgh. The state recently gave him permission to set up a live webcam near a bald eagle's nest in Pittsburgh. It launched a few months ago and has gone viral with over 1 million hits. One of the more popular moments, replayed tens of thousands of times online, is the mother eagle fending off a raccoon who's trying to steal her eggs.
These are the kind of, you know, dramatic things that you just never expect to happen. And the beauty of these cameras is that can capture all of this.
The cam has also documented babies hatching. Stoles thinks the cam is great for researchers and educators.
The Eagle Cam is an incredible way also to bring it into the homes and schools of millions of people across the entire world that might not have access to be able to come out here.
But he says there's no comparison to seeing eagles in their element out in the wild.
There she goes. You can see the white head and tail catching the sunshine now. Beautiful. Flying west to the Tinica Marsh. Unbelievable.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
And of course, we have pictures of the eagles, and you can also check out the live eagle cam on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Some people gonna call you up, tell you something that you already know. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joe Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Some people are gonna call you up, tell you something that you want.